I need my gong.
Thank you. So we got off to a great start this morning talking about this whole issue of federalism. And I just have to say, when Gordon asked me to serve on the advisory group, I did so because the issue in some ways is near and dear to my heart. I've had this incredible privilege and honor, really, of spending 24 years at Education Week chronicling state efforts to improve education and state interactions, tense, more tense, less so tense, with the federal government about how that improvement effort should occur. So I also have a strong and abiding interest, having spent 24 years trying to chronicle this movement, in making the work of states transparent and accessible to reporters, researchers, and others. Really, as public agencies, consider that part of the public duty of states is to make as much of this accessible as possible. So I'm thrilled to be here, really looking forward to the conversation. Rather than do lengthy introductions, I think we'll give Mike some time to talk. Let me just say that we really have a great panel here. I don't think you need to introduce Mike Smith other than to say the paper that he wrote with Jennifer O'Day on systemic reform, I really think provided some of the framing intellectual concepts for the movement we now think of as standards-based education. So it's great to have him reflect on what's happened since. Then we have Marguerite Clark, who can talk to us both about the state impact of some of those movements, and also put it in a global perspective. How do other countries approach this whole issue of school-based improvement and standards-based reform? And finally, Carmen, who can talk about this notion that much of the federal activity has been focused on students with special needs or students who have not been well served traditionally by states and localities, and what has been the impact for English language learners and limited English proficient students of activity in this area, both at the federal and the state level, and how do they interact. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mike.
Thank you, Lynn. Before I get started with my talk, I'd like to ask us all to give Lynn a strong round of applause. This is her last day at Education Week. She's been there for 24 years, and she's been clever enough to negotiate a move to the West Coast, where she can get a bigger view of what's happening in states and the federal government. But she'll be working with the Gates Foundation. So if you'll just join me. She has written probably the best stuff from a reporter's. I mean, undoubtedly the best stuff from a reporter's side. But also, she's gone much deeper than the typical reporter to do really serious analysis of what the issues are and how they've changed over time. And I've been one of the leading people in the yearly review of how are we doing as a country and so on. So it's a great loss, and for the Gates Foundation, it's a terrific gain. Second comment I have is that I thought, as Lynn said, I thought the first session was great. It framed a bunch of issues in terms of the way political scientists think, which gives us a real understanding, I think, of some of the complexity of what we're going to be talking about. I'm not going to try to frame it in those same terms, but as you listen to me, be thinking about the notions of fragmented centralism and its various forms, and be thinking about the venue shopping, and definitely be thinking about the implementation issues and transparency. I mean, these are all issues that that come up and are of tremendous importance as we think about the nature of policy and in education policy in this country. We are, as a very quick capture, we tend in the United States at both the federal and the state level with respect to the implementation issues to be very much like some of our corporations, and it's those corporations that only look to the next quarter. We tend to think that we need something done immediately, even though getting it done is a very complex thing to do. And so that's a kind of a theme that's throughout my entire discussion today, that you have this implementation problem that exists, and somehow we've got to come to grips with it. Okay. So I'll go through this. It's a little bit different than the version you've got in your handout. There's a couple of the slides taken out, and a couple more slides put in. So this will be a little bit different, but you can generally follow it along from what you did before. And I'm not going to go into this in any detail on the overview because we're going to do it right now, so you don't need it. All right, short history, and this is a very short history. If you track back and you look at some of the work that Maris Vanofskis, who's here somewhere, has done. He did a little piece on systemic reform, and in his analysis, one of the things he tracked back the set of ideas around standards-based reform and so on back to the notions of coherence in the school, and thinking about taking that coherence from the school to the district to the state and possibly even to the federal level. So the notion of coherence is a second notion that's going to be dominant here. Standards themselves, as content standards, what children should know and be able to do, became kind of the catchword around Washington and a lot of policy circles in the 80s, and particularly in the late 80s. And in part, what this was simply stealing. This was stealing from some other countries in terms of ideas. It was stealing from some of the states that are mentioned up here. I mean, California. Was evolving into, it had something called curriculum frameworks, which are very similar to the standards that we think about now. Kentucky went through an entire huge reform around standards in the late 80s and early 90s when its court actually threw out the entire system, and so they were able to take a really big step in Kentucky and change the whole system around a much more coherent approach to the problems. The first Bush administration was on top of this. I mean, Diane Ravitch was a real advocate of standards. The first way that the term came in was really in the NCTM standards, the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, who put together this set of standards over a 3 or 4 year period of time that really began to shape the textbooks and so on. And so its work was continually referred to as people got into this. Into this set of issues, in George Bush I's in his group, both the federal government, both the Department of Education and the National Science Foundation, and the humanities institution created standards and put them out as voluntary standards. Okay, so we have three kinds of standards that we need to talk about, and it's really important to think of these. Content standards, these are general specifications, or they could be specific specifications of what children should know and be able to do. The way they were initially envisioned was as general specifications, but they've evolved, I think, a little bit into much more specific. Performance standards have now evolved into cutoff or cut points on standardized norm reference tests. What they were initially envisioned as were actual performances of students who could do a certain kind of academic task. And so the problem is this, that if we say in a content standard that a child should be able to write a short paragraph on a certain book, on a book. So this is the standard, let's say, for second grade. Write a short paragraph on a book. What is really meant by that? And the idea behind performance standards was to begin to spell out what was meant by that. The Australians put together a set of performance standards that were really quite incredible. They'd actually pick books. They would get students to write about them. They'd take copies of that written work, and they would rate that written work to show what is really good work, what is mediocre work, what is poor work. They would make that transparent and available to teachers around the country. And in doing so, what they're doing is communicating what is the real expectation here. The expectation is not just to write any paragraph, it's to write this kind of paragraph, the paragraph that had this kind of sentence structure, that had this kind of argument, this kind of logic, and so on. And you can take that kind of argument and apply it to any of the content areas. But that's what a performance standard should really be. It should be a reflection of student work. We used to think about having one of these cocktail table books. People don't have cocktails at home anymore, but they drink wine, so it's a wine table book. And it would have in it student work from all over the world at different grade levels or at different ages. How well do they write and so on? And you could compare that. People could compare it to what their students were doing in their own school and begin to get a real sense about what kinds of work their students are doing, what's being asked from them in their school. And the final kind of standard here is an opportunity to learn standard. And this is something we don't talk about much anymore. Bill Taylor and I were talking about it last night in kind of a dreamy way. An opportunity to learn standard is simply the idea that if you're going to hold somebody to a high standard, right, you ought to give them the chance to actually get to that standard. And what is it that they need to get to that standard? And so that led to the idea of opportunity to learn standards. And there's a lot of us who believe that accountability really can't be carried out unless you have the opportunity to meet the level that you're expected to reach. So fair accountability means you have the opportunity to learn to that level. Doesn't mean that everybody's going to learn to that level, but it does mean that everybody gets a chance to. So that's what the opportunity to learn standards are. Okay. So what motivated state systemic reform? I mean, there's a vision, of course, that standards, what you hear often is that, well, there's standards and there's accountability, and that's what we have in the United States. We have a standards and accountability system, but there's something else in the middle, and that comes back to the word coherence that I was talking about a few minutes ago. The observation in the late 90s and even before that was that federal and many state policies are incoherent. You heard a lot about that this morning in the first session. Kind of a cacophony of discordance when you put together the federal level, the state level, the local level, and so on. So that was one concern. Second concern was that there were two curriculum, and there still are in the United States in many, many places. There was a curriculum for the well-to-do, and there was a curriculum for the poor. And the fundamental concept here was that the curriculum for the poor was a watered-down version of the curriculum for the well-to-do, and therefore the kids who got this curriculum, received this curriculum, would never catch up. Because if they don't get the material, they're not going to learn the material. If they don't get algebra, they're not going to learn algebra, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can just play it right out. So if you have a different curriculum, then you're doomed to failure. And finally, the idea that organizational theory, I mean, of other kinds of businesses, private businesses, but also of hospitals and other places, had a body of literature which suggested that if you begin to align your resources, you're going to be more effective. You need to align them around something, and that what you aligned them around was standards. Those became your goals, in effect, standards and performance standards, content standards and performance standards. You'd then align resources around those, and that became the driver in thinking about changing the system. Okay, why the states? And that's an issue, I think, that came up again a lot this morning. Lots of reasons for it. 10th Amendment is one reason, obviously. These layers of policy is another reason. The way I like to think about this is to divide policies into two categories. Now, this is very simplified, but you have technical policies and you have adaptive policies. Technical policies are relatively easy to implement. You can distribute money to the states. It's a policy. You can distribute it fairly evenly to the states because we've got a census that allows us to evaluate whether we've got poor people or rich people within a state and so on. And so we could target money more to the poor. That's a technical policy. If we want to change what goes on in a classroom, if we want to create a new way of teaching reading or a new way of teaching math or whatever, that's an adaptive policy. That policy is going to play itself out very differently in the 96,000 schools around the country, and I guess well over a million classrooms. And it's going to get there. It's going to be adaptive for a bunch of different reasons. One is if it's done from the federal level, of course, it goes through all these layers, right? I mean, you've got the legislative layer with the compromises made. You have regulations written by the Department of Education with compromises made. You have the state departments of education all making their own judgments about what those regulations and that legislation says. And then they write guidance. That becomes a biblical almost to the districts. But the districts often change the Bible, do a rewrite of it, and send it down to the school level. And so you get down lots of mixed messages. But at the same time, you're having to adapt a single policy, a single line of policy, to all the variation that exists throughout the country. And there really is a one-size-fits-all mentality that goes on at both the federal and the state level. And that one size doesn't work. Yeah, the other point in here that I think is really important is that the ministries in many other countries where there's a national, quote, a national curriculum, are generally run by educators. The decisions are generally made by educators. They're by people who've been in the schools. Often these are folks that have gone all the way up through the schools, been teachers and then principals and then kind of head of a district or maybe an HMI in some of the English-speaking countries, and Her Majesty's Inspector. In the United States, those policies aren't typically made by educators. They're made by a mixture of politicians and lobby groups. And it's not the same thing. You can't make the legislation as coherent, as together, because everything gets modified as you go through. You're making so many different compromises. So the original intent here of standards-based reform was to create a coherent system with standards, content standards, being the driver, content standards as the goals of the system. And then you had alignment. You had alignment of policies. You had alignment of assessments. You had alignment of accountability around those standards. That's the basic idea, right? But you'd also have some sort of restructured local and state governments, and you'd have the resources, flexibility, and responsibility to meet the student standards. So that's the opportunity to learn standards. And so these three sets of standards now would interact and work together to form a system where the accountability was fair, the standards were clear, they provided guidance, where there was professional judgment made about modifying the instruction to meet the needs of students, where you'd have more personalization. Individualization, it's called individualization in the United States, it's called personalization across the world. And the idea is that you create feedback loops that students need special attention. You need to continuously evaluate where students are and then give them that personalized individual attention as they go along. And that's the way you begin to get your equality into the system. Use a lot more tutors in schools where the kids need them a lot. Et cetera, et cetera. There's a variety of different ways to do this. There's also was a notion then, which was never put into any law, about ideas of professional accountability, not just performance accountability, but professional accountability and reciprocal accountability. And these are different kinds of accountabilities, but you need that whole cluster of accountabilities in order to make the system really work. Okay, so the Clinton reforms come along in 1994, actually passed and signed in 1994. If you look at the literature on how does research enter into policy, one of the big ideas in that literature is that it's a big idea, that there's a big idea that gains credence over time. It gains credence because people hear about it, it makes sense, there's a good storyline with it. The storyline of alignment's a good storyline, everybody's always complaining about the the discordance, the confusion in the system. And so you create these storylines, you begin to create a package. Somebody looks at it, modifies it a little bit, another package comes out. And after a while, you begin to get a consensus around the set of ideas. And the consensus was fundamentally around the idea of standards along with alignment and then with accountability. Goals 2000 was brought in as a way of kind of priming the pump. It's money out to the states to do things like create state standards-based reform. And all that language was in there. States did a lot of different things with it, but it was kind of open money to them. They could use it for lots of different purposes, and that was a very specific strategy, because people at the federal level knew that it was going to be very hard to get some states on board, and it was very hard to get some states on board. In the first year, I think only 30 states took the money. And then it became 40 states and so on. Mike Cohen flying around the country, going to state legislatures and making arguments and going to governors and so on, literally going to practically every state that there was trouble in. And there were a lot of western states, a lot of southern states where there was a lot of trouble. So you have the beginning of a structure that came along. And right after that, IASA was passed. And the idea in IASA was that you had to create a standard system for the poor, but you also had to create the same, that if there was a state standards system, they had to have, they had to be under, the IASA had to be under that state standards-based system, so that the kids who were poor were also served by the state, by the same state standards-based system. And so it was a way of beginning to move the states toward having a common standards-based system. I mentioned the implementation of the system. It's a really important part. I actually believe it took a bad rap because Lynn actually wrote that by the year 2000, or actually in data collected in 2006, the vast majority of states had made substantial progress on the outlines of this particular reform. The implementation issue, to get it done in 6 years, I think, was really quite extraordinary given the situation, given the context. This also applies to, I believe, No Child Left Behind. It's only been 5 years, actually 5 or 6 years, since No Child Left Behind came in. We can't expect it to be fully implemented in that amount of time. So NCLB comes in. Huge amount of concern by federal lawmakers, I think, frustration about the results of NCLB, of standards-based reform, and the natural instinct of the lawmakers was to get tougher. Frustration leads to toughness. Frustration leads to striking out and trying to make something happen. And basically, that's what they did. They took the basic structure that was in the IASA of the standards-based reform. They took that structure and they pasted on a whole bunch of testing, 2 to 3 times the amount of testing. They pasted on stringent accountability requirements. They pasted on ways of teaching reading and so on, and expected that all to be implemented suddenly and perfectly, and believed the theory behind it. That is, they believed that if you got much, much tougher in accountability, those teachers were going to work a lot harder. Not a very good theory, in my view. It's worth arguing. Okay, so what are the achievement consequences of it? I'm going to look at two achievement consequences very quickly. The first one is saying, okay, does standards-based reform work? So prior to 2004, what was achievement growth like? And after 2004, what was it? After 1994, prior to 1994, and after 1994. So what we're looking at is changes in the rates of gain. All right, 9-year-olds in reading. Between 1975 and 1994, as a nation, we gained 1 point in ninth grade for 9-year-old reading, 1 point. That's a gain of 0.05 points per year. Between 1994 and 2004, over that 10-year period of time, there were 8 points gained. about 1 point per year, 0.8 points or so. But take a look at blacks and Hispanics. Blacks gained 0.3 points per year between 75 and 94. They gained 1.5 points per year between 1994 and 2004. 10 points is a grade level. So between 1994 and 2004, African American children gained about a grade level and a half in ninth grade for 9-year-old reading. And Hispanic children gained almost 2 grade levels. If you look at for the 13-year-olds, you see the same kind of results. Right? The gains are a lot more in reading after 1994 than before 1994. This is pretty important because it begins to give you an idea that, in fact, standards-based reform worked, or at least there's a correlation there. Now, math is a little bit different. In math, there were solid gains from 1994 on, but there were also solid gains before. Okay? So now let's go to between 1994 and 2002, and then after 2002. 2002 was when NCLB was passed. Again, in math, you see the same rates of gain for both groups. Solid gains, serious solid gains for both fourth graders and for eighth graders. But in reading, you see something different. So in reading, what you see, if you look at whites here, now we're looking at for 9-year-olds for fourth grade reading, they both gained about the same rate. Both gained about 0.6 grade levels, 0.6 points per year. But African-American kids gained almost double during the period of time from 1994 to 2002 than they did from 2002 to 2007. And Hispanic kids gained about 50% more. So their gains were greater. And if you look at eighth grade, what you find is even more powerful. You find gains of about a point for each of the groups between a point per year between 1997 and 2002. It's only a 6-year period of time. Compared to 2002 to 2007, it's either a negative gain or at best a gain of 0.2 points per year. So what you see is in math, the same rates of gain, and in reading, very different rates of gain. Both of the rates of gain in reading in both grades, it favors before NCLB was passed. So that leads us to 4 questions. One set of questions, I think we've got to begin to debate a little bit about what the federal role can be, what the state role can be. We have to begin to think about what the differentiation in roles is. So how can the federal government support greater equality of results, support school improvement? How can it be supportive rather than prescriptive? I mean, this is the issue of balance in the governmental structures. Suppose that the federal government stopped requiring standards-based reform, including accountability. What would happen in the states? Third is the word world has changed dramatically since 1994. You know, the word technology has not been used here at all in the last 3 hours, not once. You know, there wasn't any web in 1992. I gave a talk to a bunch of graduating seniors yesterday, and we talked about what's happened in the 18 years that these kids have grown up. And there's all these extraordinary things have happened. And yet we are trying to design now, as a collective we're trying to design something for 2008, 2009, 2010 that's exactly... We're using exactly the same kinds of thinking that we used in 1992. And the world really is very different. It's different in so many different... You know, you just think about the economy, you think about the communication, you think about the nature of technology, the delivery of technology. Somebody mentioned that that you can only change if you get down to the classroom level, the relationship between the teacher and the student. You can only change achievement if you're down there. I think that's very true. You can change. That is the place to go. But think about achievement more generally. People are learning all the time from technology. How do we begin to harness that in the schools and outside of schools around academic issues to really change the nature of what we're doing? And finally, we've learned a ton about learning. in the last 20 years. We just know a lot more about how to teach, about how to instruct, about what the feedback loop should look like, about how to personalize all of this, and we don't have a way of capturing that knowledge. One very powerful way that the federal government might be incredibly useful is to begin to put that knowledge up and available to people all the time, in as unbiased a way as it can possibly make. So those are big questions. I have my own answers to these questions, but I'd love to hear your answers. The next two or three years, I think, are going to be very, very important as we begin to think about the reauthorization of NCLB or the reauthorization of Title I. I think about it as Title I. My own view is that we shouldn't start with the existing law. We should start with a conception about what we want our children to know and be able to do and what we want our schools to look like. And it's not just in math and reading. And it's not just in history, science, and so on. It's as citizens, as people who are going to grapple with the problems of the world that are unbelievable at this point. And global warming is going to affect these kids, your children, in a way that we can't even imagine now. And our kids have got to be able to grapple with those things. And so we ought to start with some conception about where we want to go and then begin to figure out how we get there and what the different governmental responsibilities are. So I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Mike. So, Carmen, one of the traditional roles of the federal government, as Mike noted, has been to be aggressive in supporting the rights of underserved students, minority students, those who have not been well served by state and federal governments. What has been the impact of state standards-based efforts and then of, at first, as Mike mentioned, IASA and then No Child Left Behind, on limited English proficient English language learners in particular?
I'm going to talk about that impact as it relates to New York State specifically. Yes. And the work that I did in New York State when I was the coordinator of the Office of Bilingual Education. But before I get to that, I was really, a thought came to me, Mike, when you talk about the implementation problem, and I have to always relate things to my own Puerto Rican culture and language. And in Spanish we have, in Puerto Rico we have a saying that says, friendo y comiendo. That means you're doing things, planning and doing at the same time. And that's exactly, it just describes it in my mind exactly what you were talking about. And that's really what has been going on in implementing Title III, not only in New York, but across the nation in NCLB. We had to be friendo y comiendo continuously. The limited English proficient students in New York represent the fastest growing segment of our population, with about 200,000 identified each year. They come from different countries, speak one of 200 different languages, enroll every single day at every single grade level, and they bring with them educational backgrounds that may be excellent to youngsters who have absolutely no formal, very limited or no formal educational background. Despite all of this diversity, this subgroup classification is based strictly on their lack of English proficiency. The impact of federalism on their education had its inception on the civil rights movement in the 60s with the recognition of that the sink or swim generation of LEP students was not being educated. However, even before the Lau versus Nichols Supreme Court case, the New York State Board of Regents had issued its first Regents position paper on bilingual education. The paper described the needs of the LEP students and the commitment to provide them with an adequate and appropriate education. Prior to NCLB, federal grants for programs for LEP students were going directly to the districts, and the SED, under my leadership to a large extent, provided technical assistance to help districts, and that was our role, and also to help them come into compliance with the Lau remedies and also to implement bilingual education programs under Title VII. And that was a lot of fun. Then Title III of the NCLB, No Child Left Behind, really triggered some very dramatic and immediate changes, friendo y comiendo, on how we did business. Our role at SED changed overnight from being providers of this technical assistance to full responsibility for the implementation of the Title III NCLB program, including the allocation of funds, approval of district plans, and managers of a new, brand new accountability system, friendo y comiendo. A positive result of all of this was that the conversation on the LEP students expanded to many, many offices, in fact, to all of the offices at SED. This was a very good thing. It was no longer just out of our office that things were being done for LEP students. Title III also revolutionized the education of LEP students, resulting in wonderful educational opportunities, many challenges, and some disastrous student outcomes. It required that all LEP students be identified, that their progress in acquiring English proficiency be measured annually with a valid English proficiency test, and that they be included in the state's accountability system, and that they also meet annual measurable achievement objectives. Ironically, it is the only group or any the only subgroup of students under NCAB that currently required, Ironically, it is the only subgroup of students under NCLB that is currently required to be tested twice annually in English, once to measure English proficiency and again to measure proficiency with another instrument to measure performance in English language arts. In New York, I'm going to have to summarize a lot of this stuff because of time, but in New York, we started working on education reform way before NCLB. And one of our, the New York strategies for raising standards was approved by the Board of Regents back in 1996, which required higher standards in the core subjects for all students, including LEP students, assessment in the core subjects in certain grade levels, high stakes high school graduation requirements that required that all of our youngsters, including the LEP students, pass Regents examinations in five different areas. Fortunately, those were made available in five different languages. And including among those tests, passing an English Regents test for our limited English proficient students. That created tremendous objections throughout the state. That is still in place, even though strong recommendations were made for alternative procedures for late arriving limited English proficient students to be able to meet that particular requirement. That requirement is still in place. I'm going to skip some of my notes. Maybe I can discuss it in the small group, because I want to talk just a little bit about the archives and my experience with the archives in New York. I have been sensitized, and I wish that I had known what I know now that I'm retired from SED about the importance of the archives and really saving documents. I mentioned, I must confess that I am bilingual, but I am not archive proficient. I did, however, and I have instincts, good instincts, I did, however, for 20 years, file, fold, and keep copies of almost every single little piece of paper that came to me and that I processed in any way. Because I planned to write the book about the history of bilingual education and the education of LEP students for our students in our state. And you can read all of the rest of my paper will be in my book that that I can't do today. When I retired 3 years ago, I took home copies of some of those files in lots and lots and lots of boxes, and instinctively I archived them in my garage. And we did this. They were there for a while until they were rescued by the SED archive detectives, John Sutter and Jesse Brown. And the lesson to be learned here is that in cleaning the office, my former office, back at the department for my replacement, what happened was that many, many of the originals that I had left behind were thrown out or misplaced, or we can't find them anyway. And I really think that we need strong guidelines out there, at least we do in New York State, on the importance or how to protect documents, which ones need to be protected, what we should do with them and about them. And I wish I had known that when I was back in the department, and that would have helped. I have several recommendations. We need more for title for NCLB or whatever reauthorization is in place. We need teachers. We need teacher education programs. We need more funding. If we're going to have all of this responsibility, the states need the money to be able to implement these programs, and we can't afford to continue the policy of friendo y comiendo. We need time to plan before we implement. Thank you very much.
Story.
Sorry. Here we go.
Better? Carmen gave us one particular state story. You've done research looking at all around. And so wanted you to step back and give us a broader picture, sort of as federal law rolled out, what was the impact in states? How did they react? And then also because we tend to get somewhat parochial in the U.S. about our own particular approach to standards-based reform, what might we learn by looking globally at how other nations have approached a similar set of issues or problems?
Can you hear me? Yeah, I'm going to have to hold this up, I think. First, thanks to Mike for giving a great presentation, and to Lynn and to Carmen. In my previous life as an academic, I did a postdoc with Carl Kasel, which involved looking at the topic of state responses to the No Child Left Behind Act. And I'll just briefly summarize what I did and what I found. And the findings are very much in line with what Mike presented in terms of the long-term trends of states on NAEP and how that has or has not been affected by No Child Left Behind. For my study, I wanted to look at all 50 states. I didn't want to just look at just one. I wanted to see the whole federal or U.S. landscape. And I wanted to try to see what states' responses were to this major federal law and also to try to anticipate the effects of that law on student achievement in each state and across every state. So here's what I did. I started with states' policy starting points at the time No Child Left Behind was signed into law. And I gave each state a score based on the degree of congruence between its existing standards-based reform efforts and the requirements outlined in No Child Left Behind. So basically, I was mapping every state's standard-based reforms effort onto the No Child Left Behind template. And if you got a higher score, it meant that your pre-existing policies were more similar to the federal law if you got a lower score, it meant that it wasn't similar. And guess who got the highest score? Texas. A great example of states' impact on federal policy. So I should have stopped there. So I used those scores in two ways. The first way was I used it to group states into three groups: low, moderate, and high congruence. And they were used to represent implementation contexts. And I used those groups moving forward to see if states that were very different from what the federal law was requiring, were they going to respond differently to states that were more similar already to No Child Left Behind. So that was moving forward from 2002. But I also used states' individual congruence scores looking back in time. I looked at their performance on NAEP, on the state NAEP, in the 6 years leading into No Child Left Behind, in a regression model, a prediction model, to see were states that already had No Child Left Behind-like policies, were they able to make bigger gains on NAEP? Were they able to close the achievement gap? So it was like a pretest of No Child Left Behind. Try to see, is this going to be any better than the varied, multifaceted, standards-based reform model that currently existed in 2002? Okay, cut to findings. My first finding was that regardless of state starting points, they pretty much all were moving towards implementing the No Child Left Behind requirements at the policy level in the first few years. Although this created significant difficulties in some states, particularly if there were rural states or if there were budget issues. But they were all still moving towards this No Child Left Behind model. So it was a good outcome for this more demanding federal approach, you could say. However, when I looked back in time at how states were performing on NAEP, I found that states that already had No Child Left Behind-like policies weren't doing any better than the other states. You didn't see bigger gains in them. You didn't see a closing on the achievement gap. And I think we've seen since No Child Left Behind was passed into law that has played out, that in particularly in terms of the achievement gap is very resistant to these kind of policies. My conclusion. The conclusion I ended with in my chapter was that given my findings that maybe it was better to allow more state variation in the absence of having a rigorous tested model that the federal government could require all states to apply. The conclusion that I personally came to that I didn't write in my chapter was, I will never do a study like this again. It was so hard. It was so hard to find the data. And even when you did find it, every state had a different definition. And thank God for Lynn Olson and quality counts. That saved me to some extent. But it was very hard to do any kind of cross-state work on this topic. I think moving forward, it would be great to have some kind of common definitions. A central database would be wonderful. You could just go to. Let me just move to lessons from other countries. Is that okay? Eek, I'll do it really fast. Mike already mentioned some experiences in other countries. I want to focus in particular on low and middle income countries, which is what I work with at the World Bank, because I think what is or is not happening in those countries highlight some of the factors that may be underpinning the current state-federal relationship in the U.S. I think in a lot of low- and middle-income countries, you don't see the lower units, whether it's a federal system or not. The lower levels of the system do not really have an impact on federal or national level policy, which I would primarily relate to the capacity issue. I think capacity needs to be thought of not just in terms of does a state or a local district have capacity to implement federal policy, but does it have capacity to influence it? And I think in many low and middle income countries, they don't. Another piece related to that is that the factors that do influence the kind of assessments and accountability models that these states have come external to the country. U.S. states don't just impact federal policy in the U.S., they also impact what many developing countries are doing, particularly in the area of accountability models. I hear time and again ministries asking me, well, what are our states doing in terms of rating schools? Do you know of any good models from the U.S. for how states come up with ways to rate teacher effectiveness? I think it's interesting that the U.S. states are being looked at in that way outside the U.S. I want to end with the concept we have mentioned often today, and that was the concept of fragmented centralization. Yes. When I was reading Lorraine's paper, I was in Mongolia, which does not have a federal system, but I was struck by Lorraine's elaboration of this notion of many different policies being implemented by all these different units, and it was very sophisticated and complex. And I had just come back from collecting data for the Grade 5 National Assessment in Mongolia, and it struck me that this kind of country was a great example of coherent or unitary centralization, because when we were out collecting data in outer Mongolia, I have been there, not only were the parents delighted to fill in the background questionnaire for the national assessment, but they also wanted to know, when were we going to fix the roads and what were we going to do about the power supply? So to them, we represented not only the education ministry, but also the roads and maintenance and electricity. So I think it again speaks to the point that if you don't have capacity at lower levels, so much devolves to the central unit in a country. And I think capacity is a key component of understanding how states impact and why they impact on U.S. federal policy. Thank you.
Okay, we are again going to turn it over for table discussions. I believe we have till 12:20 for table discussions, and then we'll again try to gather up some of those questions that have arisen from your tables for up here, at which point those questions will only stand between you and lunch. So have a productive 20 minutes. This raised lots of questions for me, certainly. So I'll dive in if no one else does, but have a good discussion.
Roving mics. Can the people with roving mics sort of wave their mics around so people can see where you are? Okay, so we have one back there, and I think we should have one up toward the front. Okay, we're just going to go around quickly to a couple tables and get some questions out for Mike, and then if the rest of our panelists, if they're sitting at a table, can also weigh in. First question, do we have one from back there? Great.
What can we do to follow through on Mike's suggestion that we not start with No Child Left Behind, but go back to defining what we want students to learn? And should we focus on the LEA level rather than the SEA level?
Mike, quick response to that.
I don't, this working?
No.
Light's on. Let me just use this. Why don't I use that? Is that live?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't have an answer. I think this is the kind of setting where we really need to have a loosely called a national conversation about this. I don't think this can be led from Washington. I think it has to be led from other places, like the Governors Association, like the Chiefs, like a variety of the other organizations that actually reach out and touch the states, maybe Great City Schools, and then begin to bubble it up, because Washington's not going to listen, I don't believe, until they hear it from people outside of Washington. Lots of you are from Washington. I'm from Washington for 15 years. I think Washington gets itself into a trap. It listens to itself and reinforces itself, and then comes in with something that's a tiny little marginal change in whatever the law is, as a way of addressing the law, and then goes home and goes to sleep happy that they've done something about this problem. And they haven't done anything about the problem. There have been a few times when Washington has moved in big, big ways. I see Bill Taylor shaking his head. One of them was obviously around the civil rights movement and the ESEA in 1965. ESEA did not come out of Washington. ESEA came out of a lot of research that had been carried out. It came out of people who came to Washington from other places. John Gardner, people like John Gardner and others. And he came out of at that point the Carnegie Corporation. He'd been listening to a lot of people thinking hard about poor kids in the country. He'd seen the research, and he and some others began to put it together. The same thing is true, in the basic civil rights movement started by Brown, and in some ways it's actually started a lot earlier and worked up through. So this is the whole idea of a big idea moving into Washington. You're not getting big ideas that come out of Washington. So that would be my simple answer to it. It's not simple to do.
And I saw we had a burning question at table 6, and also I know table 3 was waiting to get in, so can we get a...
We have a bunch of questions at this table that all kind of converge around this question of innovation, and where does good innovation come from, and how do you get innovation without getting just a lot of bad stuff?
So how do you get good innovation and not bad innovation?
Yeah, I don't want to be the only one talking here. I just one question. Lynn and I were just talking about this, and this is something that the federal government really could do. But it would, it has to be done without an ideology around methodology, without an ideology around the right way to teach, without an ideology around the issue of ELL kids or of disabled kids. It's got to be done in a transparent and independent way. Federal government, very simple for the federal government to put $300 million, $500 million into serious work on R&D on the bridge between what we're learning about the brain, what we're learning about cognitive science, what we're learning about the use of technology, and its application into education. This is a slam dunk. Any one of us sitting down with one other person could in a day put together an outline of an agenda that would be incredibly powerful and would change the nature of this country in 5 or 10 years. But we don't do it. Instead, we bring our ideologies to the table, and then we argue about them and compromise them, and it ends up without very much happening. So how's that for an upper?
And I think we had another question at table 3 I saw, and then we'll gave it to me.
Gates
can
do it, right. We'll ask Lynn to do it.
Okay, well, did you remember which one it was, Kathleen?
Well, I can try to read it. We had to rewrite it, but I think it should be, why do you think
NAEP scores have flattened out under NCLB after rising between 1994 and 2002 under state accountability systems. Were the gains under state systems a result of new research in reading?
I doubt that there was the new research in reading. And certainly, you mean the earlier gains, you don't mean the later gains. I don't think so. I think there was a, I think there were two or three things happening. One was a little more alignment, so the resources were a little bit better focused on achievement. I think there was a lot of talk. If you think back then, and you, there was a lots of talk about instruction. I mean, we were talking about what Tony Alvarado was doing in District 2. We're talking about what other groups were doing in other districts around the country. There began to be some talk about what's going on in North Carolina, what's going on in Texas, what's going on in Connecticut. And here's Connecticut exploring issues around professional development and really using that as the lever into their strategy. In the meantime, you know, what's happening in Massachusetts, and you got Massachusetts kind of moving along in a very interesting way and now showing up. If you looked at the mapping of Massachusetts eighth grade, right, eighth grade math scores, they beat every country except a few of the Asian countries. They beat every one of the developing world except a few of the Asian countries. I mean, this is extraordinary. So you've got these great victories that have gone on. I don't think it's any magic bullet in Massachusetts. I think it's a lot of hard work, a lot of alignment, a lot of thinking about improving instruction, and so on. So I think what happened was that you began to get this kind of activity going up until about 2001, 2002. And then you had a pin stuck into that balloon, or it was deflated because suddenly everybody was saying, you know, you're doing a lousy job. We've got to get in there and really kick some more ass and be very tough about what we're doing. And that frustrated a lot of people, and you saw it all over the country. And you talk to teachers and you see it, and frustration. You begin to set bars. I mean, there's a huge amount of psychological research on this and motivational research on this. If you set the bars so high that they cannot be jumped over, people don't try to jump over them. If you set the bar a little bit below that, at a level where it is manageable but challenging, that's the place you want to set it. You want to be really thoughtful about setting it, and it has to be transparent, and it has to be a performance that means something to parents. It can't be a cutoff score. They don't know what that means. So I think what we got hit over the head. I mean, I think the education establishment got hit over the head. People said that they weren't doing their job. They've got to talk faster. I mean, Al Shanker used to get asked on radio shows, you know, how do we get raise the achievement scores, and how do we, you know, do this and that. And he would answer something about, you know, we'll get the teachers to talk faster. and everybody would laugh, right? But that's what we've been asking our teachers to do over the last 6 years. We want them to talk faster.
So I think it's actually time for lunch, unfortunately. This was a great session, and I think it raised even more some of these sort of tensions and paradoxes that we started off the morning with. And the one that kept coming to mind to me was Lorraine saying, you know, policymakers gravitate towards high-stakes tests because it's a lever that they know they can pull into the classroom. Mike saying, boy, but one of the most destructive things we've seen is this focus on high-stakes tests, which then raises the question, well, if that's the lever, what could the federal government start to think about doing in this area that might be different moving forward? If we're still going to be doing testing, we're still going to be doing accountability, is there a different way to think about that? So lots of interesting paradoxes around that as well. Lunch is down the hall to the left, the same place we were for breakfast, and we have 45 minutes is what I've been told.